Welcome to Out of the Woods, the Threat Hunting Podcast.
Hello, everyone. First, I want to welcome everyone to our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting live Discord interactive podcast. This really aims to cover some burning topics relating to threat hunting, security stuff, things that hopefully everyone wants to hear, talk about, and participate. Just as a reminder, throughout the podcast, we'll be taking comments and questions from our Discord server. If you want to participate, make sure you sign up using the link in the welcome message. Also, for future podcasts, if you find interesting topics or ideas you would like to discuss here, what we're kind of doing is if you can tag in LinkedIn or other social media, hashtag Out of the Woods Podcast, all one word, we'll see that and we can actually pull that into some things. So as you guys are doing your daily jobs, looking at things, interested in things, want to hear more input on things or just dive into it, we're more than welcome to do the same. So that's one way to share with us. So check that out. So quick introduction. I'm Scott Poley. I'm a threat hunter at Cyborg Security. Have a whole list of things I've done historically in cybersecurity. Check me out on LinkedIn. Connect with me there. And then I'll pass it off to Lee. Introduce yourself real quick.
Hey, everyone. Lee Argmell here, cybersecurity analyst. That was my first role in cybersecurity. Actually working under the great Scott Poley here. He taught me a lot, both in networking and cybersecurity. But then we kind of both parted ways because I dove into the detail stuff and Poley went the tougher route and did processes and management. So, but we're back again, which is always great. But yeah, check me out on LinkedIn. I post a lot and I hope you enjoy those resources. So I'll pass it over to Scott again.
I'll pass the mic.
Hey, I'm Mike. So one of the co-founders at Cyborg with an engineering infrastructure product background, and had the pleasure of working with these guys on the daily. They taught me a lot about threat hunting, the deep dive into the process, and really excited to be back on the podcast. It's been a minute.
Yeah, it's nice to have you back. Something else that's kind of special about this podcast, if you guys are an active follower and saw this early enough, we also do a special cocktail for podcast. This time it's the Ransomware Resolver. It's actually probably my favorite one we've done so far. It's a bourbon-based drink, but yeah, if you enjoy it, check it out. We'll ask questions later for feedback. But let's dive into what we typically do, where we cover the three interesting artifacts, or I say we all find our own interesting artifacts to kind of share to kick off things we want to discuss before we get to some other topics. So with that, I wanted to share a couple things that I like first. So one thing that I've shared even with amongst the team members here, but for those that aren't familiar with all the different random naming conventions you see with attack maps and things, there is a really good kind of open source, openly maintained Google spreadsheet of APT groups and operations that actually does a pretty good job breaking things out. I found this is a really good resource, as you can kind of see as I'm kind of clicking through here, how they tag and move things. And I don't know how you become a contributor to it, but I love it because, like, for instance, if I'm asked, like, hey, do we have coverage for this or can we build things for this type of threat? I now have a keyword list of things to go research and find to help me navigate and drill into where things could be hiding on the internet, open source intel, things like that to try to pull a collection together. So I find it very useful for that. So definitely check that out. I'll throw the link here in our Discord real quick so you guys can check it out live. So that was the first thing I wanted to share. I thought it was a really good resource for that. I don't know if Lee or Mike, you've checked it out much.
So just checking out now, and the power I see from this is getting all the names aligned, because that can be the biggest issue.
All the aliases, right?
Yeah. Right. Like just, I mean, B-Bus. I mean, come on. No one, I've never heard of that. Not that I'm some expert, but you know, it's just a nice place to capture all the information that you can, so that if this is like the best effort I've seen so far, so that if anyone's talking about anything and they use an alias, hopefully you can come here, figure it out. And I like the idea that they gave some background information about them as
well.
Because that's what we focus on, right? The behaviors, tools that they used, on things they've done in the past, and all the historic data is just as valuable as the aliases themselves. And of course, you can always respect the references that they added, which is crazy because I like that they go all the way to link 25 sometimes. That's a lot of resources. I think it's awesome.
It's I've been using it a lot recently for some internal projects, and it's really interesting because there's such a breadth of intelligence services out there, and everybody wants to call something their own name. Like Microsoft just rolled out their new naming convention for threat actors. MITRE has one, CrowdStrike has one, Palo Alto has one. It gets confusing, right? And I think, you know, having a source of truth is really important. I would love to see this get pulled out of a Google Doc, and maybe put into some sort of database that you can hit via API, pull out a little bit. There could be a service around this, right? Like an aggregator. It really helps with trying to understand intelligence, right? Because we get asked all the time, hey, what do you know about actor ABCDEFG, right? And that actor is related to maybe 15 other aliases that CrowdStrike, Microsoft, and so on and so forth use. So it's an amazing resource. Kudos to the person that put it together and is managing and maintaining it. That's got to be a pain. You know, there's got to be some automated stuff on the back end, but there should be a source of truth. This is it, I feel like. It's the best resource I've seen, at least. But again, I would love to see this kind of pulled out and used as kind of an API resource. I'm curious to see if other organizations use it, right, to pull in.
Right, that's true.
Other intel organizations specifically use this as a resource, especially as you start to talk about source country, some of those finer details around it.
Yeah, and I like how, I mean, they just kind of shows the power of crowdsourcing, right? Like, you know, one of the things about the security community is we work really well together. I mean, you can kind of see just interacting people here on our chat that they know us, we know them, we interact with them, we share information. It's just a good representation of that, I think, because I don't know when this Google Sheet was started, but I'm assuming it was started a while ago, and it's just been kind of maintained by people dropping things in, so.
Yeah, because that's got to be tough for him to accept those changes. In a manner that's not like, you know, time consuming, right?
Right.
So it would be really interesting to, I'm surprised nobody's really tried to build this into more of a product, but it seems like it could help out a lot of other organizations.
Yeah. So the other thing I wanted to show, and I kind of found this, it's called Dredge. Really what it was for was how to look for secrets that could be potentially stored on a Linux system or probably a Unix system too. And the idea was it was more of an attack-based tool. But I know when you look at a lot of attacks that hit big Linux servers and things like that, and where the lateral movement kind of comes from is they're able to gather some information or something they can use to then utilize later in the attack. And so from a defense perspective, I thought this was kind of a great resource because you might not know how well something is hardened, especially if it's like a public facing server or things like that, where you don't know what secrets even exist on the box or there's better ways to protect them. So it was a way kind of like self-discovery where you can take something like this. It's supposed to be more efficient, make it easier to manage. Like they talk about how they store or output the data in a way where you can manually go through and easily identify things of more risk than things that are just more noise. I haven't used it myself on a box specifically because I kind of came across this in the near term. But I thought it was a really interesting tool about how you can basically profile your Linux servers, especially public facing ones, to see where are key things that could be stored. You know, do you have like AWS keys and things stored somewhere? Do you have, you know, passwords or tokens or things that may be leveraged in some way? Just to kind of basically self-assess. So yeah, I don't know, Mike, you're in the infrastructure side of things. I mean, do you see stuff like this that you'd have to worry about as far as where things are stored?
Sure. I mean, the I like this being on the server side. So GitHub has a lot of resources that it can push up repos. There's, I think, the Pindabot and some other services that allow you to scan those repositories to look for keys. I've seen that. there's some lessons learned in past lives where people had pushed up API keys for AWS.
Yep.
And people grabbed those resources and started spinning up EC2 instances and charging a bunch of money, right? And so having those services scan things on the edge, things that are external, are really important, especially if you're coding, right? If you're a programmer and you're building script and you're punching in hard-coded values because you're working quick and you're like, all right, I need to commit this, and that goes up and it's public, dang, right? So there's a lot of services that scan GitHub. But on the server side, right, it's the same thing. You know, a lot of times if it's not exposed server, there's less risk. But again, if you're in a large infrastructure, if you're using things like Kubernetes and you have to have out external services, this is a great tool. I think this is another kind of lesson that we kind of eat our own dog food, right? So those tools that are used for red teaming and the tools that are used to you know, potentially break in a lottery move, hunters and the blue side typically grab those and use those themselves, right? And so this is a great example of that. Set this up as a scheduled task, or actually we'll get to that later. set this up as like an automated thing that runs every week against your service, right? If it's low touch, if it doesn't spin up a lot of resources, if it's something that you can generate a report off of, maybe you push that to your SIM, maybe you alert on it if you find something. Like, this is something you can set up. Maybe take a couple hours to get this implemented, but this will save you a lot of time and effort, in the long run. Mm-hmm.
I just like the fact that they still incorporate the raw queue password list. if you're not familiar with it, and I heard it first, I'm not some OG, I heard it first from Jack Resider and Darknet Diaries, but the raw queue company, apparently they were like storing passwords all in plain text, and they got hacked, and there was this giant list of passwords that everyone was using. And they went through, or not them, but analysts went through and found the most common passwords and threw them in this raw queue list. And that was back in 2009. So the fact that it is, I mean, it's kind of scary, right? If you're still getting popped, we're finding passwords that exist on that list. I mean, not negligence on your part, because I mean, you can only do so much as an organization, but I guess education and training needs to be ramped up. But then again, reusing passwords, all those basic principles that exist out there when it comes to passwords,
You're right. It's interesting. We're now seeing products trying to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. You have like a zero trust framework. So SAML, I think they understood that like the human will error, right? It's hard for humans to understand passwords and keep long passwords. And that problem got obfuscated away with product and process. And so I think the further we get closer to that, the idea of that password kind of, refresh your password every 30 days, it has to be more than 32 or 8 characters, and all that will kind of go away as these other services and tools come out. But you're right, like, shame on you if you're still using passwords in that list. There's an article a couple of years ago that in a patch life, we used to have a password cracker, and it took, what was it, a couple minutes to break an 8-character password or something like that.
Oh yeah,
GPU now that speed has gone way down with the the recent increase in compute, and so that is what's probably driving a lot of the other product and process, because if you get those hashes, you can crack them pretty quickly.
So I'll have to pivot to you, Mike, and telemetry.
I was logging into GitHub the other day, and on the homepage, this popped up. So it was kind of a serendipitous kind of find of this repo. I kicked it over to the team. This is very interesting for us, right? So not to pitch the product, but we deal in tools. We deal in visibility. We deal in capabilities. And so this was really interesting to see this project built out, right? And this is at the benefit of organizations that are looking at switching products, buying products, really understanding the visibility and capabilities of these tools. Why this is important, I'm about to go to RSA in a couple of weeks. We've all been to Black Hat and the team, and we've seen the marketing, right? We've seen the, this will protect you 100% against everything, right? A lot of that's BS. The same tools that are saying that, I saw one on this list. There's a big X mark against like 30% of the visibility that you need to find the actors and the threats that are available today. And so that's telling, right? If you don't have the visibility to find something, it might have worked 5 years ago, but these actors, these threats, this skill craft is growing and changing over time. If you can't find something like scheduled task creation or process modifications, register key modifications, like that's problematic, right? And so this list, what he did is he compiled a list against all the documentation for all these tool sets. And there might be things that he's missing based on documentation. I'm guessing there was some automated capability to checkbox some of these things. And then he ran atomic tests against all these hosts to look for visibility. Now, with that being said, the atomic test, it might not have been the best method of visibility for what they're looking for, right? It could have been a very simplistic test or something that was configured a certain way. They didn't find it on the host. You have to also look at all the host the EDR configurations and set up for all these different tools. So there's a lot of work that goes into this. So the effort is greatly appreciated. I would like to dig into maybe the specifics on the technical side to see where he's getting some of these values for visibility. One of the ones that I want to kind of pose a question to y'all is, though, is on Sysmon, right? I saw some X's there. And so for me, in understanding Sysmon, right, there is a config file you can apply to Sysmon. The default is very minimal on the visibility because it is resource intensive, but you can expand out that list. Palantir has their own Sysmon config that is very detailed. There's a lot of other resources out there. And so if you adjust that config, I think the visibility changes. So I'll pause there. I'll kick it over to y'all, other experts. But is that the case with what you saw here in this list?
So let me run first.
Go ahead. Thanks,
guys. Go ahead. All right. So yeah, that was something I wanted to call out is I would say Sysmon's a great augment visibility tool, right? But like clearly there's some things it doesn't monitor. Like they had some like user like scheduled tasks directly, no, but from registry you could. Things with like user activity and login and stuff, it doesn't do any of that. So there are specific things that happen around the system. Sysmon isn't great, but Sysmon's really good for things that are occurring on the system from a lot of attack perspectives. But the one thing I wanted to call out that I thought was really interesting, so I really like Sysmon specifically for the registry side of things, because if you look at registry activity, almost everything in this row right here is checked green across all tools. There's some of these exclamation marks, just I don't know if that's like a maybe, but it's green like across the board. But I know in working in predominantly all majority of these tools, that registry visibility means yes, they do see some registry keys, but they don't monitor them all equally. But when you have things like Sysmon, the advantage is you tell it what to monitor. You can configure that. So there's some things that could be misleading from the data because it's such a high level, right? But it's a really good place to start to say, where does the capabilities exist? But you still have to verify, for instance, if I'm looking for a specific behavior from a threat hunting perspective, emulation is still very important to say, okay, I know this tool has that telemetry. Does it capture that specific telemetry around what I'm trying to identify, right? So I think emulation is still very important beyond this list, but this is a great place to say, what should I expect so you can identify those gaps outside of that? But that's where I sit with Sysmon. Like, it's not a collect everything type tool, but it's a very targeted tool for data collection. And that's why I like it, because if you have another tool, for instance, that doesn't have the same visibility, but they kind of have the same check marks, You can augment it with Sysmon. And that's really what I see Sysmon as, is kind of a way to augment your visibility, not necessarily take it all over.
And absolutely. I actually think it's kind of unfair that Sysmon's here. It should be like an honorable mention or just like a side note. Because quite frankly, if you have Windows, still like some of these logs that you're relying on or that it's looking at are found in Windows native logs.
Like natively, right? Yeah.
So if you're looking for a user account, you're not going to find that because, you know, Microsoft realized that, hey, we have all this robust logging that looks for communication to DCs, you know, Kerberos activity and all this stuff, but we don't have really good EDR stuff. So let's create that. And then they built that to be like, what is it? I think it's 26 events now. Where
around that.
And like you said, they're just supplementing. They're finding the endpoint activity where all the other event native event logging is here. Where I do appreciate, like you said, Scott, is that you can really configure Sysmon to look at what you want, registry key-wise, whereas all these other EDRs have been designed already as almost black boxes to say, we're looking at this subsection of registry keys. You can't configure that. So if you want more visibility, then maybe a solution like Sysmon pumped into your SIM will work. So those are my thoughts. Kind of, like I said, kind of, not that Sysmon doesn't belong here, but when it's compared to all these other devices that have been designed as full endpoint protection versus supplemental logging for your Windows, for your native logs, it's kind of like it doesn't even compare.
So can you go back to that real quick? So like registry key activity, a lot of the tools in here have incomplete or exits, right?
But registry is great across the board, but that we know is not complete. I said registry is complete across the board as far as green, but it's not really complete.
Yeah, well, go back real quick to the left. You see some yellow
arrows. There's two yellows, that's about it.
Yeah. And then so the X against some tools. How do you supplement that? Right. So if I'm a user of that tool and I see that, oh crap, right? Like what do I do?
I mean, yeah, that's a tough one to answer, right? Because a lot of times you're kind of invested in a tool already. And depending on the deployments for tools and contracting for tools and things like that, that's just kind of, you have to look at what tools you have in a collection. So when you think of an operation, you don't really usually rely on one tool. You might have your stronger and your weaker tools. But that's something as you look for renewals on things, and you look for whatever, you really should be having this type of perspective is, where's our visibility? What are our problems we're trying to solve or our gaps? What are we really good at? And you're always kind of assessing what are the next steps to make that better. So when I was running SOC previously, we did a really good job of identifying our strengths and weaknesses with technology, figured out how to make technologies work really well together. And to be completely honest, we didn't focus, based on how we ran the SOC, on what's the tool that covers down like all the green checks. We wanted to find a tool that did something really well that covered down maybe a few of the green checks, but then integrated really well with other systems for like a SOAR, or can interact with other platforms. So you can take the strengths of two systems and figure out how to make them work really well together. And kind of, then you can start building some automations and things from a SOC operation perspective. And that was kind of our approach. So I think it just kind of goes with what are the problems you're trying to solve today? What technologies do you have? And where do you want to be 5 years from now, year from now, 3 years from now? And that's just part of your roadmap as strategy goes, right? Like for instance, threat hunting, a lot of people don't have it in their shop, but is it part of their next year plan, their 3 year plan, their 5 year plan? Like, how do they know how that's going to fit in? How are they going to grow their operation? How are they going to mature it? I think those are always questions that management should always be looking to answer.
But is there a way to cover down on that visibility immediately or supplementally?
Sometimes you can get creative on the system itself. So a good example of this, I've heard of a solution, for instance, where proxy, right? Proxy data. You can see all the web traffic that people go through, but the proxy, if it's not in the cloud where you always are using it when you're off-prem, because now remote work's a thing, you only get captured data when it's on-prem. But the proxy was removed, and now visibility was gone. And the analyst had an ingenious way to basically write a PowerShell script that would go grab the history logs from the browser to capture that URL data and then feed that into their SIEM solution, right? They had a way to basically grab data at certain points where they know it's going to be sitting, but not necessarily logged, to solve a problem that they had really good content, but they lost that visibility. So I think that's a great example of where sometimes a solution isn't something you can just buy off the shelf. Sometimes you have to use some native tools and knowledge to solve, but that was a priority. And since they prioritized on it, they figured out what are some possible solutions and they made it. Now they have to manage it because it's a homegrown solution. So there's that cost involved. But that was a huge gap, and obviously offers a huge win for them. So it was worth it.
And I see here, at least for this example, for registry activity, for anything that's missing something there, I think Sysmon kind of edge covered, right? And that's a free solution that you can deploy, literally break down your config to just that, and well, that data, right? So there are solutions to cover down on the visibility. I think you, like you said, you have to get creative a little bit, right? Because all these tools are fallible, right? They're not going to protect you, as they say, 100% of the time. And it's really understanding the visibility. And that's why I think this repo, I started, I will follow it. I think it's going to grow to something really cool, and keep organizations honest, which is very important, right?
Yeah.
So.
And I think we talked about this before, and I think I'd probably even mention it as well, but the question is, how do you cover down? So the easiest approach that I take a look at is look at your event types, look at the logging that you have, look at the information that you want. Is it there? If not, okay, well, how are we going to, you know, figure this out? Hopefully, in most organizations that we talk to, they have a SIEM and an EDR. So EDR is not so much configurable for visibility. SIEMs, you can pump whatever you want into it. Unfortunately, with that comes cost. So if you're pumping up more logs, you may be paying more. But I know I said Sysmon doesn't really belong in here as a comparison, but that's where Sysmon really fits. And I will keep saying it until it happens, but I can't wait to see Sysmon come natively on Windows machines. I thought Windows 11 was going to do it. They're not. It's going to happen. Maybe I'll just tweet it once a day, every day until it happens. But the whole idea is, you know, like you said, Sysmon's free. If you don't want to pump those, go ahead.
I lost my thought. Go ahead.
Mike, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the reason probably why it's not deployed automatically is because the layman user is not going to use Sysmon. So I know it's deployed at a corporate level. Now, if you talk about like Windows 11 business or Windows 11 corporate or something, sure, right? But like if you go to Best Buy and buy a Windows laptop and it comes with Sysmon, what are they going to use it for, right? Like imagine your parents like digging into Sysmon logs.
I mean, come disabled, right? But it's like the fact that it's not built in for you to just enable and manage.
If you're just disabled, right. But if you can't pump it in your SIEM, at least have it locally. Then you can have some like forensics source. But you can cover down, look at your event types, look at the information that you want, see if Sysmon will cover that, configure it to do so. Yes, I say it's free, which it is to download, implement, but I know time and resources with the people that are actually configuring it, going through the logs, seeing what needs to be tuned out. So I know that takes time and resources as well, but it would be such an advantage to take that, because I mean, you don't have to go through a POC. You don't have to go through a wholesale or whoever the case. Just download it. Microsoft Sys Internal Suite.
So I was going to say, I remember my thought, and that was, I think it was our very first podcast here. Someone was asking about like what data is the most important. And I shared a couple articles where somebody's done some analysis based on MITRE techniques, what fields and data is required to answer certain those questions that identify those things. And it was surprising that I think 500 and some was just answered by command line alone, right? So granted, all these artifacts that are listed here are very valuable depending on the scenario, but I feel like a majority of threats, depending on their sophistication, can really be distilled down to, you know, a core group of things. And I think Sysmon, why we harp on that so much, is it covers probably 90% of what you need to have visibility to, outside of auth, but auth's just native. So,
yeah, and I think the other important thing that I would love to see out of this repo eventually is, like, why does that matter? So you see the deltas between the subcategories and the features and the telemetry. I think somebody in the facts asked if they were going to apply MITRE TTPs to it, which is great. TTP is fine. I would love to see contextual intelligence data applied. So, like, why does it matter that you can't see service deletion as it relates to threats and actors?
I've never dealt with an incident, nor have I ever read an Intel report where our virtual disk mount was something I was concerned about. Now, in a scenario where that is leveraged, I'm sure I would like to know and be able to see that, so it's easy for me to investigate. But, we do have some content that kind of tailors to that, but we find it in different ways and at a specific alert, right? So, you know, that's what's interesting about, there's a lot of really good artifacts, but they may not all be necessary depending on majority of things, right?
Right.
Cool. All right, Lee, I'm going to kick off to yours, which is your favorite thing to talk about. I hear you talk about it a lot. That's why I say it's your favorite. I don't know if it's really your favorite or not, but Windows scheduled tasks.
What do you mean? So, yes, I do love some scheduled tasks. And more importantly, this resource.
That's a great resource, by the way.
So I probably share the most 101 style resources that I ever find. I love the technical stuff, but I really, really appreciate something that can explain a basic task, a basic idea, in a very well-versed form that anyone that is familiar with processes and the way that Windows operates can understand. Mm-hmm. I always look at these things as being the like the senior or principal analyst or hunter on your team, that, you know, the person that you wanted to teach you, who do you want that to be that person. And seeing things like this, it's great to see, because, you know, you don't have that like barrier of, well, what is the schedule task? Or, you know, it's like, we'll figure it out. Well, yes, we can all figure it out. You know, we're trying to analyze it. But when people step up and publish things like this, where they're like, here's the lowdown, here's not only what it is, but how it's relevant, and then how you can find different things, you know, why it would be suspicious, what is, you know, then it leads you in all these directions for just more and more search. And yes, I do love scheduled tasks. I love persistence mainly. Yeah. I love the different, looking at the different ways of persistence, because if you can find that, it is kind of like the biggest slap in the face to the adversary. Like, you thought you had to put
validation on. Too, right? Because I feel like when you find persistence, it's the one thing that is like a true or false, something bad happened here, right? Execution, you could be on the fence, like, well, did an admin do this? Did a system do this? Did a, you know, application do this? Persistence is kind of like a, yes, someone's here that shouldn't be here, right?
Yeah. And just finding that, not only does it give you a lot of ammo, to say, like, listen, we're actually compromised. But it gives you, there's just so much, thanks, Windows info is always good. Yeah, because there is so much out there. There's so much about Windows.
But it's funny because it's always the same Windows things that are being utilized, like you said, this is a great take it all in a one chunk, right?
And they have a lot more.
I've never seen CyberStreams, but I like the concept they have built out here.
Yeah, and they follow the same kind of thing, like, you know, using this for an investigation. Then, you know, and the great thing about this is it's not just threat hunting. It's not just build an alert about this. You can take this, you can apply it to threat hunting, you can apply it to detection engineering, And if you are a DFIR analyst and you're like, well, I'm dealing with hands-on bots and, you know, artifacts like that, well, you can find stuff like that too and still apply that same information. So it hit a wide range of audience and cybersecurity professionals. I just really enjoy them. I enjoy when the new ones come out. I've been going back and reading the ones they previously posted. And it's always good to refresh, right? Even the basic stuff.
This is an amazing article. I think, to your point, like, if you have the time and the resources, like, read through these, right? Like, this is explaining the service, what it does, the normalcy of those services. It's a struggle. And then, you know, the things that are flagged, that could be flagged from a malicious standpoint. But it gives you a breakdown of the things that, like, and as we talk, and Lee, you're doing work on this right now, about what is normal in my environment. What are the things that are consistent, that happen all the time, that are normal to the operating system? What are my false positives, right? As it relates to everything, right? So if you're looking through logs all day long, you're going to see things that are normal. And you have to be able to identify those to understand the things that are not normal, right? And so this does a great job of explaining all of that. I think it was very interesting at the bottom of that article, though, it talked about intelligent scoring of artifacts. So being able to apply scoring against the things as it relates to the kind of the identification of, you know, if a task is created within the last 30 days, suspicious, right? Unusual locations, link files. The one that was interesting, though, is if it's hidden, they say it's related to Hafnium. That's a little scary, right? immediately, it's like red flags go off. But it's a, it's an amazing kind of a list of things that you should flag. And maybe you score those things internally, right? Maybe you have your own kind of alerting or priority against those different identifiers of where those tasks are. If you're in a large organization, let's say 10,000 people, maybe you have SCCM set up, you have group policy set up. That should be very rare that you have scheduled tasks created often, right? That's normally a big business level decision to build in these type of processes across everybody's computer, right? And so that understanding, again, your environment, your infrastructure, getting to know your admins, right? Getting to know your IT people. Having those relationships and having that communication is super important to understand what's going on, right? If you're a threat hunter in a bubble and you're doing all this work and you don't have that communication channel, and I think, Scott, you've talked about this a lot, right? And Lee, same thing, where you're not effective if you can't reach out and be like, hey, what is this thing? And it's not this big red flag, you're screwing up, IT sucks, right? Like, it's got to be this kind of collaborative environment. So I think this all goes into just understanding the environment, right?
Yeah, why I really like the concept of intelligence scoring is kind of like what you were saying. You know, how many scheduled tasks should you expect to see? And it would be kind of cool if people were able to bucketize certain things. So, like, from a detection engineering standpoint, now granted, I grew up in the ArcSight days, right? That was like my first sim, and that's...
I'm sorry.
But, there's
everything else is easier, right?
Yep.
Well, everything else is different. but, like, the one thing when you think about intelligence scoring is, like, imagine creating some sort of detection off of just scheduled services happening in general. And then based on what that is, having scores based on this is something we see across 1,000 hosts, so it's likely normal. This is something we see across 5 hosts, it's slightly unique. This is something we see on 1 host. Right. And I feel like that's how in my head intelligence scoring can work. And that's a really interesting way to handle behaviors within your environment as you start to learn about it and normalize it. So that's why I really like that concept, is like, I feel there's so many ways you can build that into your processes. Right. But the other thing I really like about this article in general, and I'm excited that you kind of brought this source to mind, Lee, probably saving some time, is when I build hunt packages off of a concept, I don't like to just address, like, threat report says they did X, right? I'm like, okay, well, how many ways can you leverage X? What does X mean? What do I expect to see in X? So I started like just digging in general. So like a good example is I was looking at Chmod for Linux, right, recently, and making things executable. And, you know, one of the things that really stands out when I was digging into it was anything that's given a odd number, regardless of who you're giving execution to, is executable. And then you can use the X and do whatever. But if I just focused on a specific threat report where that was being leveraged, I'd be focused on like 700 or 755. As that's the specific number I'm looking for in Chmod when you're running the command, or just plus X. But there's so many different variations I want to account for. And the reason why that's important is I don't want to have to build the same hunt package multiple times, nor do I want to have to go back and revisit and figure out how to build it and then validate and test again. If I can test for all the things I can potentially come up with and be very inclusive, but not, you know, create a noise problem, I feel like there's value there in articles like this that capture everything in one, like here's the kitchen sink of everything on the topic. That's hugely valuable because I try to stitch the same thing together on topics in general when I build things. So this is, I think, awesome for that, covering a specific topic.
You mean you don't want to create a hunt package based on a scheduled task and every different parameter that it can use and that has ever always been used?
IMCs? I would do it, but I would try to do it in a way where it's not going to make me hate my life. Yeah.
And you know what? This article saves you from going, or saves you for the most part from going to reading the Microsoft documentation. So you don't have to give them that satisfaction.
We have a question.
I'm looking at it. So the question is really, what tools or techniques do you recommend on monitoring sysmon hidden registry files, which are hard to detect as malware use obfuscation techniques? Even using EDR detection rules to view telemetry data does not always yield the desired results. So I guess to clarify on hidden registry files, so I know actors will stash things in a certain place in the registry to read from. And that's kind of harder because they can pretty much create anything anywhere, especially in the user space, as they see fit. But as far as like, the way where services were created and deleted from the Halfdam, you know, example from the services, there's a registry thing that was created and there's a registry thing that exists, but the service doesn't show up properly. So really, it just comes down to Sysmon's really good at anytime you see an interaction with a registry that you know is important in some way. Either it can be levers on the system for certain privileges or UAC bypass or things like that. You kind of create a list of those. And any activity around those sysmon's going to fire. And then you kind of have to do your due diligence to say, why do I care? Do I want to dig into this or not? Alert management from a detection standpoint. And that's why I usually like hunting for certain registry keys, because some might be noisier, especially when you're dealing with COM objects and things like that. When you look at the CL SIDs, there's a lot of UAC bypass stuff that happens there. What's up, Mike?
Yeah, so I think I'm back. Oh, I'm on the right side of Lee now. This is awesome.
I'm staring back.
So I think from the techniques or tools, right? So you made a really good point. Monitoring for registry keys, right? Hunting for registry keys. That's where you need to understand kind of from a visibility perspective your environment. So let's say we have a hunt, or we're going to hunt for every registry that was created over the last 90 days. Now, understanding the services and the maybe programs that create registry keys, because that hunt's probably going to turn a bunch of values, right?
You can also differentiate between set and create too, which is also a different way to view the SKU, right?
Exactly, right? So then you start to whittle down from those exclusions if you understand your environment, maybe the software, the services, and the things that are normalized, and then pick out those little needles in the haystack, right?
So something you brought up that I thought was really important that I like to look for registry in general. There's one thing about monitoring registry keys, but what Sysmon gives you the ability to look at is what is making modifications to registry keys, like from a process perspective.
Right.
I think that's huge, powerful, right? Because actors typically use a few common ways like PowerShell, reg.exe, and a couple others to modify the registry directly. And I feel like that sometimes is a great view too, but you have to have those keys monitored on Sysmon to be able to tie it back to a process.
Right.
This is definitely a very hard question because there's multiple ways to, and there's even multiple ways to monitor a registry. You can use Sysmon with ENCODE 12 through 14. You could use Windows native logging if you use 4.6.5.7 for modifications. Then you have the more robust like 4.6.5.6 that is always fun. And Alex,
it was all her video memory.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. because 4.6.5.6, and I apologize. So 4.6.5.6 is a handle to an object was requested.
Touched, right?
No, requested, not touched.
Oh, that's one before, right? Then the 5.7 is a touch.
4.6.5.7 is registry key was modified.
God, I'm trying to use my memory better than you, and I can't.
You got way more. Well, that's the thing. You got way more up there than I do.
Conceptual. Right, you're a literal. I got it.
Yes. so you got 4.6.5. If you turn that on globally, you're going to blow up your SIM, and everyone's going to be mad. So you got to be careful how you audit that. But that will tell you what files may have been accessed. If you go to event code 4.6.6.3, which is actually 4.6.5.6, is saying that something was accessed, then you can see what was actually touched. But then you run into that same problem of that's really, really noisy. And if they are using obscure registry keys or obscure locations that you didn't expect or that have never been used in the past before, then you're either boiling the ocean to try and find that one thing, or you're just going to miss it and hopefully determine that, we'll catch the execution, we'll catch the persistence or the C2 or whatever the case may be. So sometimes you do have to admit that where we can't see the registry key modification. Maybe we'll find that later throughout the rest of the investigation or through malware analysis. It's not an easy answer. You can definitely prioritize those registry keys like Scott mentioned and Mike mentioned that have the high impact. Which ones are used to elevate privileges? Which ones are used for persistence and so on? And those are normally the ones that are caught up by the EDRs. And
I've got three things to consider when it comes to registry. You've got, like we've said, the things that are obvious that you see from threat reports and things you should care about that you know are being, like, for instance, registry run keys. You should probably have those monitored in general, right? There might be a lot of noise that comes with it, but you need to have that telemetry because it's a great place of persistence, and it seems like a lot of common malware just uses it in general. What processes are changing the registry? Another thing to be looking at, but could be noisy, and obviously there's known applications, so there's going to be a lot of exclusion there. But if you're able to even just do a collection and look for rare things, if you were able to sort based off the least amount of processes that are touching registry, that would be really insightful. The third thing isn't so much that you normally collect on, but things like Conza and things that let you remote into machine, or if you're doing instant response, looking for really, really long values in registry keys. So things that are like greater than 250, I want to say characters, but there's like a bin value, but you can do characters, right? Because they're usually like base64 encoded and stuff like that when you want to put scripts in there. That can let you know when maybe scripts or weird binaries are being dropped as far as being stored in the registry to be pieced together, put together, or utilized in a malicious fashion. Obviously, there's some normal things and benign things in there, but those are the three things I typically think about to rehash that in short term. Known registry keys to look for, what processes really change registry, and long values. That's kind of where my head's at. So,
yep. Thanks for the question. Thanks for driving that discussion further. Nothing's easy to solve in cyber, right? Like we face some immense challenges all the time. So there's a lot of creative people out there. I think these resources are amazing though, right? Like to Lee's point, I know you say you bring up the 101s, but that's the important base of knowledge to be able to do a lot of really interesting things.
So it's funny, and I don't mean to carry this on longer or just straight from the path, but Mike, you played professional baseball, right?
I did.
How did you get there? Because you did all the cool stuff really well, or what?
No, I was fundamental. You know, coming out of high school, I was tiny, but I was a good base runner, fundamental, could hit, could run. College, I had to grind it out. I wasn't the flashy guy that just hit home runs all the time and did like the bare minimum. But I think that's the case across the board with baseball, right? Like it's fundamentals first, and then you get to go do the fancy stuff, right? And so I think, and you coach baseball, right? You coach sports, so it's fundamentals first, right? And then you grow the other skill craft.
And that's what I tell them. I'm like, listen, the basics. I was like, professionals are professionals because they are masters of the basics.
Yep.
They didn't win us like at this spot because they were able to bat flip a certain way,
right?
They were very good at the basic things to do, hitting off a tee, fielding a grounder, making accurate throws. That's how we need
which
to
makes,
approach everything.
Which makes consistency, right? Consistency is important.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And if you are not, if you don't have strong fundamentals, there's maybe you can grow, but you'll never have that strong foundation of understanding.
Yeah. I've interacted with some people in cyber that were like specialists in their one little space, right? But as you grow outside of that, they were lost. And so that's fine, but like they didn't have a generic understanding of, you know, the core competencies, but they were really good at that one thing, right? And y'all are successful, Scott, you and Lee, y'all dealt with a bunch of, you know, y'all had to be in the grind of it, right, to get to where you are today. And that's important across the board, right? It's always my favorite people in cyber were the ones that were always trying to learn, always gathering knowledge, always wanting to talk to people and share knowledge. And those are the guys that are super successful in the space.
Absolutely. And I know he may or they may not be here, but looking back at Rabner back in March 20, they had a question about they're new to threat hunting and they don't have any threat hunting experience or certifications, which is absolutely fine. You don't need a bunch of letters after your name. What I always recommend.
You spell your name with letters. I'm just kidding.
Right.
Make your own letters. What I always recommend, and I think, so they have Security Plus, which is one I always recommend. They said CCNA, which is a step above what I normally recommend. Normally I say Net Plus or Network Plus and Security Plus. Network Plus will give you the basics of how computers communicate and the language and all the information of how things communicate, because you need to be able to speak the language to understand what's going on. Security Plus takes all that information and puts a different twist on it and puts a different lens on it. So that gets you thinking about Net Plus being operations, where how do I get this to work? It's working good. To security of it's working, but is it working as intended or securely? I would recommend SAMS courses all day, not to beginners. SAMs are your very, like, I've been in the field for a long time. I mean, holy, you've got the same jump, I'm pretty sure, right?
That's over his right shoulder. I think those are all the SAM certificates, right?
No, these things?
Yeah.
I can't do a line with the whatever up there.
He can't do a line because it actually extends around the corner. Like,
it's a siding of his house, actually. It goes outside.
His roof? No, but...
I'm a glutton for punishment.
Those will be the basics, right? Net Plus, Sec Plus. If you want to become an analyst, I know CompTIA even offers the CISA Plus, which I'm not saying it's necessary, but getting into the SOC is a good place to be. That's where I started. I went network in the military. I went security analyst in the civilian world first. And that's where you learn the event logs. You learn the information. You learn the intel that everything holds. You learn how detections and alerts are built and why the conditions are so. And then you get that whole attack pattern into it. And then threat hunting is that step above where you take all that application and put it into, I wouldn't say it's a step above. I would say it's, once again, putting a different lens on it. Security operations, that's reactive. Threat hunting is proactive. So same idea, just in a different way where we're trying to find it before it alerts anything.
I think, and to caveat that, and then I'm going to point you to that next question we just had, I think threat hunting can be both. I think it can be reactive based on intelligence and, you know, alerting. So typically if something fires off, now what, right? Let's go look for the behaviors in our environment. Let's go hunt for the things that we need to go hunt for, knowing the signs of what is, you know, triggered. Riptide, great question. I know Lee, you're a big fan of active countermeasures.
From
a networking perspective, just I think in my experience and talking with the team and internal and all our guys, threat hunting for networking communications is a little tricky due to the fact that a lot of these threat actors now have access to things like Let's Encrypt that give you the ability to encrypt your data, encrypt the payloads, encrypt the traffic. Easier and quicker than in the past. And so,
something I want to add. So network, I think the biggest challenge with network, and this is why I like Zeek, because it kind of summarizes a lot of the data you may be interested in.
Big fan.
But one of the challenges of network is, imagine if you're on the endpoint and you turned on all logging. Because in network, you can't pick and choose what network data you want to necessarily capture to say, I've got network covered. You pretty much give me, I want PCAT for 24 hours and it's rolling, right? So you're really collecting everything and have to sort through all that. So you need some sort of analysis tool to help you, you know, either pilfer through it all, sort it, stack it, whatever you do with it, right? Versus like at an endpoint, we're very targeted. We know how to be targeted. We know how hackers use those specific things. And I don't think that grace is given the same way. The network side is kind of like, give us it all the data and then we'll figure out what to do with it. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges from the network side, but there's great tools. Like I'll harp on Zeek all day long just because it gives you actionable data. And if you can get man in the middle, kind of like your SSL inspection, like you would do with a proxy or something like that.
Right.
Really, really, really beneficial, right? So then having the right tooling to where you can kind of like pipe that into Zeek, you know, in between is a lot of value. Like a lot of times people do that with IDS, right? Because IDS is still ineffective if you don't have the visibility of the parts of the packet as well. So you kind of do the same thing. But Zeek is really your visibility there. And a lot of the analysis that, like we mentioned, Rita earlier in the chat, you're really looking at models around communication as far as, you know, what's the frequency of the communication, what is possibly the jitter associated with that communication, what does it look like over time, how does it communicate? It's doing that analysis based on Zeek data, based on length of time communications, when things communicate, all those types of relevant things. That's the C2 solution that I'm the most familiar with. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. So I got 2 points. So on the C2 side, right? So there's a lot of intelligence streams out there that at least understand the infrastructure that a lot of these threat actors are using for that C2 communication and beacons. And so to Lee's point, he just posted the question, how do you define threat? I think there's a couple things you can do to protect yourself against the C2 communications, right? There's laundry lists out there of IP addresses, domains, URLs that are used. Those shift all the time. If you have a method to automate that, that's a great tip of the spear alerting mechanism, right? To understand what's actually reaching out. If you can correlate that to the actor or the threat, now you can hunt for the behaviors that are going to happen post that activity and protect yourself, right? So I think with Zeek, you can threat hunt based on the way that they kind of pull apart the services and the different, or we'll call them detection mechanisms, but they give you all the data that you need against DNS, HTTP connections. Like, they got a lot of really good data.
And they have really good patterns for handshakes and the way things are stood up too. Like, they have that whole scheme of like out of the letter schema that I always have to look up what each letter means as far as how things are established, right?
And now there are tools like Corelight, shameless plug that we partner with, though, but that has
Zeek is their product, right? Zeek's their free, Right.
Yeah. And to the point, though, again, we talked about open source tooling and the ability to get that installed in organizations. Zeek is an open source tool. So if I went to my director, if I'm in the side, I can say, hey, I want to deploy Zeek across all of our organizations and sites, and then stand up these servers and then collect the data, ship it to the SIM. There's a cost associated with that that's kind of unknown, right? It's really hard for you to plan for that cost against all those endpoints and network traffic. If you're talking about Splunk, you have data in, you know, it's really hard to kind of build that plan where they are these tools now that are privatizing these services. But I think it's you know, beneficial. And the other point was, Scott, how long have you been in cyber?
15, 16 years.
15. Lee?
2015. Wow, almost 10 years.
There we go. Congrats. We'll get you a, what's 10? Is that like silver or wood or something?
Give me a splinter. Congratulations.
Right. But to the point of that is, and I think I've been in for about 10 now as well, a little bit more. PCAPs were the thing you had to have from a security perspective back in the day, right? So you had RSA, you had Impulse. You said you were in the ArcSight days. Like, that was the thing. That was like the gold standard, is like you had to capture the PCAP. You had like petabytes of hardware in your data center to capture that data. And then we started moving to the cloud. We started having a little bit more visibility.
Yeah, and where's that visibility going? All the way to the cloud. It gets really hard.
Right. It's wild to see that kind of immediate shift between let's capture all the network data we can to we don't really care about that. Let's just get the endpoint data. Let's capture the edge stuff. Let's capture the metadata about the network, not the actual packet. So it's been really interesting to see that shift over time, I think, in cyber.
So the one thing about C2 that I like to talk about too is, like, obviously there are specific malware, right? And when there is malware deployed, you can use a lot of IOCs and intel sometimes to help with that problem. But the one thing that happens a lot, like, for instance, if you look at like Chinese actors, they're really, really good at web shells, right? So they're attacking web server infrastructure. They're establishing a sort of web shell, and they're seeing the callbacks and things like that. And I feel like if you're monitoring the right things, first off, an interactive web shell connection on a web server, the connection length alone is going to be way greater than your standard anyone interacting with the website, right? Depending on how you set up your website, I guess. I'm not like a huge expert in this area, but from things I've looked at, that's how it's been, right? So like just looking at an understanding where people are going to attack and establish C2 outside of just the endpoint, but you also got to understand that there's not just malware. Like, look at ransomware groups where they're doing like AnyDesk. That theoretically is a C2, right? Like, they can get in, do command and control through legitimate tools. And so C2 is like a bigger problem that you have to solve in different ways depending on what it is you're dealing with. And I think off-the-shelf stuff, especially if it's not like off-the-shelf offensive tools, you should be in a pretty good place to handle, because it's really easy to sit there and say, well, I'm going to inventory all these specific things, and you can very easily say, well, this is what it looks like when it's installed. This is what it looks like when it communicates. You can kind of profile all those things if you wanted to. And especially with the stuff that's actively being used, there's good information out there. Web shell stuff, I talked about the connection list and how web shells are installed. But sometimes you can look for, if you even have file creation visibility on specific servers, you can look for specific file types that are leveraged in web shells. And maybe there will be some noise associated with that depending on the processes for maintaining websites and services. But those are other things you could be looking for or looking at as well, as far as the visibility and data you want. So yeah, C2, I feel like sometimes it gets bottled down into like a single topic when I feel like there's a lot of subtopics, they get addressed differently, and kind of like everything in cyber, right? Like, it's never like an easy solution for this specific thing. Yeah. But it's always important to keep that in mind of what does that mean, and know what solution fits what best. Don't try to have one solution that solves all, mm-hmm. essentially.
And I posted it once again, shouting out to one of our favorite sources, the DFIR report. They did, and this is more touching on beacons than C2 stuff. Well, I guess C2, specifically Cobalt Strike C2 beacons.
Right.
Going back, We got Sysmon. Event ID 17 covers named pipes.
Yeah, pipes.
And named pipes are the ways that two programs can communicate with each other. And that is a good way. And Cobalt Strike itself has a defined list of default or default named pipes. Let me grab that real quick. But that's a good way. And not that it's a surefire way, but what happens is a lot of these reports involve C2B or Cobalt Strike simply because it's off the shelf. They have access to it. I mean, to get legitimate access to it, it's a little tougher than getting illegitimate access. But they have that capability, and they pass it around, and they use it. And if you are a script kiddie, or if you are a junior, and you're attacking, and you don't know how to configure it, or for the lack of, for the reason that you just want to get in smash and grab, so you don't configure it yourself, if you just use the default features, then, I mean, that's a way that you can speed up the attack, but it's also a way to get caught because of the named or the default configuration.
So, and you know what's unfortunate about Cobalt Strike is in the early days when we weren't all 64-bit systems, one of the easy ways to detect Cobalt Strike was because it would use 32-bit libraries and exploitation, you would see 32-bit like SysWow 64, right? You see a lot of binary paths associated with that when Cobalt Strike was hitting an environment. Not so much anymore because things have changed. But something else I want to mention too is you think about C2. C2 is really important, but something else that you can kind of pick up on is how do people proxy traffic? So when you're in environments that can't directly talk to the internet, or someone is dug into your environment, like where they're forwarding things. So C2 might exist on one node, but it has to forward through a beachhead, right, to get out. That's something that I think is also kind of easier to identify because the things would be very non-standard for your environment because you wouldn't expect that. Like if someone has a NetSH rule on Windows that basically says if anything hits this port, forwarded to this IP to this port, and they can create that rule on the fly, they basically immediately use Windows to port forward everything for you. Or there's some other ways or other tools. I want to say Ngrok, if I remember that correctly, is another Ngrok tool for something like that. Yeah. Something else similar to that. So those are other types of things to look at as well, is how to proxy traffic out of an environment that I know a lot of threat actors are using in terms of really secure environments where they're like, oh, look, we've locked down the firewall. We've locked out all these things. Well, yeah, that's true. So now C2 is not so much the method. It's more how do we proxy traffic that becomes more the technique to look for. So depending on your environment and depending on where those proxy or things could exist, that's another thing to technically look for.
Yep. So I know we have about 20 minutes left.
I know we've been killing it on questions, but we have a huge topic, so we might only get through part of it.
Yeah. I mean, we can
dive into it.
Yeah, let's get into it. Yeah.
All right. So one of the things I'll introduce the topic, and then we can kind of run through some questions on the data within the topic. So I think we'll get the link shared out. But there, SANS did their threat hunting survey of 2024, right? They call it Hunting for Normal Within Chaos. So really kind of a background of the survey, if you guys aren't familiar with it, it's their ninth year of really doing it. The goals of the survey really is to look at insight and the challenges is also how do people hunt or how is hunting conducted? And then they try to repeat some of the questions from year to year to see how things change, which kind of makes sense, right? That's the whole point. But one of the things that I want to caveat here is surveys are a great way to really collect data, but there's a lot of assumptions being made, right, by the people that are receiving the data. And also when we're going to talk about it, we may make some of our own assumptions as well as why we think the data kind of is that way. So you can see the link that's shared there. You can grab a copy of the survey as we kind of talk through it. So take note of that. One of the things to mention in the survey before we get into the kind of like the topics of the survey is the demographic. There is a lot of organizations across the world. There's predominantly a lot of more smaller organizations included in there, but there's plenty of large ones, probably 55 large organizations, which is more than 50,000 people within the work. And they kind of break out the demographic in there. But so a good collection of things as far as some insights. So I guess I'll kind of kick off with questions from the first part of it. And that is, they have a graphic that says which attackers are usually faced with when threat hunting. And I thought this was interesting because the top was business email compromise, about 67.9%. Next was ransomware, 63%. Nation states at 38%, crime 28%, and then other 8%. But what was really interesting was business email compromise was at the top. And I just would not have expected that. So first question out to you guys before I give my two cents is, what does the information that you see here as far as those results reflect on what you really would expect threat hunters to be caring about? Like, did that surprise you, or does that make sense to you? Like, what are your thoughts?
Now, I think this is the first time I've read this report. I think we involved previous. I didn't see a definition of threat hunting, and I might have missed that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right. So I don't, so again, getting information from users, knowing what I know about like the product side, it's difficult, right? You want to approach it from an open-ended perspective, or else you're gonna push them to an answer, right? You're gonna supply them with the answers that you're expecting. So was it the question of what are you hunting for? Was it a, you know, A B C D E F, or was it an open-ended thing that pushed these results? So I was kind of shocked that people were hunting for business email compromise, because that's something that is, it's something that it's not necessarily hunted for, right? Now, phishing campaigns, sure, there are methods that are logged from a phishing perspective. Maybe it's credential compromise. You know, once you have that, maybe it's lateral movement. But I was kind of shocked that that was at the top, right? I don't see that as a hunting perspective. Now, if we define hunting as looking for IOCs, maybe they were just hunting for the domains or the actors that were emailing people for business compromise, or the C2 communication that sent the data out, or the redirects, or the, you know, the spoof sites. So that's right, where I was a little confused at that being at the top, whereas like ransomware as a service, you know, the kind of the other topics underneath that were things that we traditionally talk about from a hunting methodology.
Right. Yeah. The thing that struck me as weird for that specific thing was, one, visibility, because business email compromise, typically you have an email that's compromised and it's being leveraged and then communicating to maybe like force people to do kind of wire fraud stuff, or force people to do activities within the corporation, you know, that they shouldn't be doing or whatever. But there's no like attachment. There's usually no links. It's usually just text, and it's prompting people to do things for majority of the money lost from business email.
So hi, it's me, CEO, send me $100 in gift cards.
Right. as one of the preliminary examples. Right. And so one, to hunt for that, like the visibility, unless you can read people's emails, I feel like that would be very hard. Now, granted, if you're looking for telemetry, well, yeah, but if you're looking for telemetry, like, well, we had someone from Vietnam log into this account and they'd never logged into that before. Sure, you can investigate and you can hunt for those things, but I feel like there should be alerting for that too, right? Like, that's something that you shouldn't have to necessarily spend cycles on hunting directly for. That'd be more like detection and instant response. So that was a little confusing to me as well, just based on the driver. But one of the things I thought was interesting, so I looked up business email compromise, and it's one of the fastest growing costs from a cybersecurity perspective, as far as how much it's costing companies, as far as the growth and where they expect it to be. So then I started thinking, well, maybe there's like a business justification for why people are spending time on this, because it's a priority of the business, right? Sure. Like, it's hit somebody and said, hey, what are we doing about this? How are we going to address this problem? So we spend cycles and we do things for this. And so naturally you're like, well, that's part of one of the things we hunt for, right? So that was one of the reasons why I thought maybe it hit, because ransomware is up there too. That's another cost related thing, right? It's seconds.
So for business email compromise, is that kind of like the spray and pray approach?
No, it's more targeted.
So, but if you have an organization of 10,000 people,
uh-huh,
and you can guess email addresses and you can kind of target to
percent. Well, no, it's more you own their account now. You can be them and make things happen. So like the wire fraud. So if you're like, hey, we need to make this payment for this company, it's $100,000, you know, send it here. Like that could be a big expense automatically. And that's why some people were saying business email compromises shouldn't so much fall on cybersecurity as it should the banks themselves based on the cost, because the banks should have built-in protections to say, this is weird anomalous activity, not just the fact that someone's using an email too. Right. So,
what was that previous? There was a big breach. Was that Okta? Somebody got access to an email account that spoofed the two-factor on the phone. You got a password reset, but owned that account. And then I think
true. And I want to say the dev environment, Microsoft got hit with something like that, right? They got access to an email. And so getting access to valid email is definitely a problem. And it's not, like with the comments here, it's a large attack vector, right? Because now we've moved everything up. We use email for everything. And it's not going away. 100% agree. But I feel like the data and where I would hunt for directly, I don't know. I've never taken cycles to hunt for that, because I've seen really good detections for anomalous activity about using the account, right?
Right.
But I might not have the experience in it. So if anyone else has experience for some of the things they look for, if they were to hunt for this, I'd be interested. Not saying it's not a problem. I just don't know if I would put that at the top where I would spend my cycles as threat hunting. It's just my opinion, though.
So I feel like that's going to be, like your point, it's going to be more anomalous data. Like, I've never emailed these people before. I'm logging in from a different country. I'm doing things that are outside of
the communication patterns, where you're logging in from. Those are all, and they have heuristics around that, right? In a lot of platforms today, so.
And my question for hunting.
And I was just about to say, for these two, so business email compromise. Normally, you get alerted on it, right? Hey, I got this weird text, or a user responds. God bless those organizations that get alert that ransomware is active, right? Because at that point, it's done, right? And I guess I'm not trying to knock anybody, but I see where the disconnect is. I think this question was read, what keeps you up at night, instead of what do you hunt for?
Excellent.
Alert on, because quite frankly, if I'm gonna, just like you said, if I'm gonna hunt for business email compromise, I'm gonna look for the behaviors, the weird logons, the access to weird or emails that have come in weird, you know, from weird locations, anomaly type, behaviors for ransomware. What happened beforehand? I'm looking for the privilege escalation, looking for initial access, and so on, all that type of stuff. Now, I'm very curious as well what all that other stuff is. Because I see nation states, and I want to ask, or I wish I could ask, how they're hunting for nation states. And whether that is we are ingesting intel, we are taking the IOCs, we're scanning our environment.
Well, they break it down later in the report. They really call out ransomware versus nation state. Like, what TTPs do you look for, right?
So yeah, I'm on that graph, actually. So the top 75.8% was looking up the LAN binaries. Great.
Which I thought was interesting. We'll get to that later, maybe. Yeah. But like, I was interested, why did people not care about living up the LAN binaries with ransomware? Because with all the things I've looked at, they use a fair amount of that too before the ransomware. So I thought it was interesting.
Ransomware was custom malware.
Right. Because they use their own payloads, but that's not what I would hunt for. I want to hunt before for that, right? So
the vulnerabilities, right? You don't look for the vulnerability getting exploited. You hunt for the activity after the post exploitation.
Yep. Yeah. And so a perfect example is the XB vulnerability that we've been talking about a lot lately, and that's a great example. The ES6i vulnerability, I think another one just popped today. Those things are the impact, right? It's the initial access that doesn't necessarily ruin the company or destroy the company or like provide financial value to the actor. It's all the stuff that happens afterwards. So those are the things that you want to catch. If you can't catch the initial access, and typically the information that comes out is a patch, or you typically have that information before you have the information of the things that are being exploited in the wild, right? That's the thing that happens kind of after the fact. So
that's why I always harp on post-exploitation, because even if you go through like basic offensive classes on how to do offensive things, it's like you get in, you do this. And this is the same thing every time, right? It's like you get in, you figure out where you are, figure out what's next to you, figure out what you touch. Like there is like a routine associated with once you get in. And I like to focus on that, because that fingerprints one, an actor's behavior, because they like to do that. They're creatures of habit, but it's something that's consistent to look for.
You had a great metaphor about like driving to work, I believe. Is that your metaphor? Yeah. Or like a home, right? I'm looking at my front door right now. There's a couple ways to get in the house, and there's a lot of things to do once you're in the house, right? But like typically if I'm in the house, I'm going to go look for the valuable things. So you got to match those patterns the same way to your metaphor about like driving to work, right? Like,
yeah. How many people drive to work only one way? And then, what would make you change directions? Probably protections or barriers or detours, but you're still going to get, you're still a creature of habit. You're going to do the same activities.
Lee, did you have any other kind of interesting things out of this article? I look right.
There were a couple. Let me see if I can scroll through them real quick. There was something that really. I like the. Does your organization use one or more clearly defined methodologies to threat hunt?
Yep.
And then, how often do you review or change your threat hunting methodologies?
I think we're on the same page there. Yeah, I was about to bring that up too.
you want me to talk on it real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so as far as does your organization use one or more clearly defined methodologies to threat hunting? Once again, without the centralized definition of what threat hunting is, I'm skeptical about the results. The fact that almost the majority said that, yes, we have formally defined threat hunting methodologies, I find that hard to believe, simply because of threat hunting being a buzzword nowadays and all the different definitions that exist out there of what threat hunting is.
I was going to say, I got a point to what you're saying. When you read further, it says, what was the big driver for the methodologies? And people said the CISO, 40%. And that made me feel like, are people interpreting, did they have a dedicated threat hunt program versus methodologies, which is, I feel like, the way you get the work done, right?
That's a great point.
So I feel like that might, and that's the other thing, I didn't know what their definition of methodology was, because there's a few different ways people threat hunt, hypothesis driven. There's peak, there's Tahiti, there's the four A's. I was looking up all this stuff beforehand, so I'm not not that knowledgeable. But there's a bunch of different ways people have implemented threat hunting processes. I wonder if those are the things people are thinking about, because I do feel like there's a lot more ad hoc approaches, more responsive, like reactive approaches to threat hunting, a lot of ways, and they may have their way of doing it. But when I think of methodologies, I feel like it's a program that has a rinse and repeat. I can continue this process But one call out before anyone jumps in, I really like Riptide's comment about the BEC stuff, where he basically is prioritizing where you look for anomalous behavior. I think that is the correct approach when looking for problems like this, where there's not a lot of telemetry other than some communication that, you know, you can manage, but you're looking at your high priority things. I love that approach because one, it's a great place to start if you've never looked at anything. And if you want to mature it to where you can do it at a bigger scale, great, but you might only really care about the 20 to 30 people. So great comment there.
Automatically alert on like keywords, like if gift cards in there.
Right.
No.
Yeah. The thing that caused me to kind of pause a little bit was the concept of changing a methodology or framework.
Yeah, like, that was interesting.
That's typically something that is core to the work and that you're doing.
Monthly. Like that was a cadence in there.
Wild. Right.
So right.
That tells me you're not, maybe the definition, maybe there should have been like a tool tip of the definition of methodology or framework, but like.
Absolutely. The never call.
Never.
Some of the context around that was, you know, as threats change, you might change what you're doing. But in my mind, the methodology should be able to incorporate how threats change, where your information comes from, because it goes through the same pipeline of processes, right? So I thought that was interesting that that was the expected why it changes so frequently, or whenever is needed. It's like, if the threat changes and your threat hunting is methodical, then you should just basically ingest the information from a different place and still put it through the same process. I mean, I'm not saying you would never tweak your process. It's always good to improve. But if you're improving that much, then maybe your process as a whole might be slightly broken.
And I do want to say, and I know we've been knocking on some of the stats, and I think we're data-driven people. But I believe that this report was amazing for the industry, for the visibility and the conversation around threat hunting.
Well,
there's
it's
a
great
lot of really good points that came out of this, right? One of those being that the threat hunting methodologies are up 37%. We're now seeing a rise in the understanding and the implementation and the development of threat hunting across a lot of these organizations. And that's all very important, right? So I just want to highlight that real quick.
Yeah, the one thing I think is really important about this is having things like this, regardless of what our assumptions are around the data, right? Because like I said, we're all making assumptions, is it creates this conversation. And I think these conversations are really the important thing. Like, what does this mean to you? What should we possibly be doing? If this means this to me, why do I feel this way? And how can we make it better? Like that, those are the drivers that I think this is great. So like, granted, it's really easy to be a critic all the time, but I feel like I'm a critic because I want to basically spur people to like, basically, you know, fight back or add more to the conversation in a lot of
absolutely.
Ways too. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Can I add one more.
Go ahead.
I was the one statistic I liked was, what do you consider your threat hunting maturity level? Some said they were unknown. 16% they were very mature, which I believe. Yeah. I've talked to organizations at Black Hat. I've talked to people that say, like, walk me from step one to incident escalation, which is great. What I really, really appreciated was that the bulk of people said they were either maturing or they were mature, which I wish they had a better definition of what that bucket means. But that at least tells me that, one, a lot of people are being humble about this and they're saying, listen, we're starting off, we're trying to threat hunt. Or whatever, by whatever definition we're doing, we're trying to better ourselves. And then the same bulk of people said, we've been doing this for a while and we are mature. We may have like a good methodology and good pattern going on, but there's still more that we can learn. There's still more that we can improve. And the fact that the bulk is there tells me that we're really moving in the right direction, no matter what threat hunting definition they use, is that They're not closed minded. They're like, we got this unlock, you know. That was actually an exciting statistic to see.
I think this report's super important because it's been going on again for 9 years, but they've been able to track the increase of those percentages across a lot of these stats and metrics that we've been talking about today, which means that organizations are looking, to your point, Lee, to mature, right? We're not there yet. It wasn't 100%, which is great to see, right? We want progress. We want organizations to be like looking forward to progress their knowledge and skill sets. So I know it's tough because the data is obfuscated, right? Surveys are always hard. I hate having to send out surveys to get the right responses, right? But this is definitely driving that discussion in the right direction.
Yeah, discussion is important.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're at the top of the hour, or top
yeah,
of the
so I feel like here. we'll be covering more of these pieces of this report. So if you guys haven't seen it, definitely check it out, download it, because I think the next time we'll dig in even further, because we were planning on digging in more, but you guys asked great questions. So we'd rather get to what you guys want to talk about as well. So I just really want to thank everyone for joining. Once again, love really talking shop with, you know, friends, colleagues. You know, if you like what you hear, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you really see podcasts or listen to them, and leave good reviews, because honestly, when you guys leave good reviews, it helps us get discovered more and we can bring more people to the conversation. So that's also great. Remember, if you want to add topics to the conversation as well, tag anything with the hashtag Out of the Woods Podcast, all one word. So we can see what you want to talk about, and then we can, you know, discuss on that. We also do a brief 30 to 45 minute episode that talks really just about the 5 breaking news topics, intelligence reports, technical write-ups, really of that week, and that hits on Wednesdays. So check that out as well. And once again, I really appreciate everybody's time and love the conversation.
And a few of us will be out at RSA coming up. I know we're about to hit conference season. So if you want to meet up, grab a drink, have a conversation, reach out to us. We'd love to meet you in person. Build the community.
See if you can get the, what's it called? The ransomware. What was it, Pulley?
The drink?
Yeah.
The ransomware resolver.
Resolver.
Oh, I like it. Yeah, go have some more. Let's go resolve some ransomware.
You'll forget about it after a while.
Exactly.
All right. Well, happy hunting, everyone.
Take care.
Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.